God, we thank you for the revealed word of God. We thank you for its truthfulness, its veracity. We thank you for the fact that you graciously saw fit to introduce yourself to us, not just by way of nature, but in a written book. Let us approach it as though that was your gracious act. In the name of your son, Christ, we pray. Amen. So over the past few weeks, one of the things we wanted to do is introduce you to Paul's broader point as he goes into the book of Romans. One of my concerns with how we approach the reading of the Bible is we take one passage that applies to, in our minds, applies to us, and we disregard the agenda of the author or the context in which he was writing or the audience to whom he was writing, and we make that passage personal for us. I can't tell you how many times I've seen cups and t-shirts with Jeremiah 29 verse 11 on them, because God has a plan for you. And my problem with that is everyone who reads verse 11 neglects the fact that there was a verse 1. And you don't necessarily want the plan he had for Jeremiah 29, okay? If you read that whole thing in context, you don't want that thing, okay? So I need for us to recognize what it is for us to evaluate the Bible according to the author's agenda and his hope for the audience who would be receiving it. That's important to me in the book of Romans from several passages, but among them is found at the end of the chapter, which we're not going to get into today. We're going to get into it next Sunday. But one of the concerns I had with the manner in which we handle the end of Romans 1 is we end up treating Romans chapter 1 as though homosexuality is the agenda of the passage. And I'm telling you that it's not. It's not. Does it come up? Yes. Are there things we're going to get from it? Absolutely. But it's wrong for us to jump straight to those verses because they dishonor the author's agenda. They dishonor his whole point. His agenda in Romans chapter 1 is to identify everyone as those who have a desperate need for the salvation that comes by grace through faith alone. He's showing everyone that no one is the exception to that reality. He's showing everyone, before he even gets to, this is how systematically Paul approaches this particular discussion regarding salvation. Before he even gets into the means by which we receive salvation, he spends three chapters showing you why you have a desperate need for the salvation he's going to cover starting in chapter 4. He spends the first three chapters doing that. And among the things he does in chapter 1 is shows that everyone is without excuse. He's answering a question before it's even presented to him. Because he knows that people are going to ask him, but wait a minute. But what about those who have never heard this message? What about those who have never heard of this God? What about those who are able to legitimately present to God the excuse of ignorance? I did not know. Not ignorance as an insult, but ignorance as in genuinely and legitimately not knowing. But Paul directly addresses that concern by saying that God has made himself known by that which can be seen. Not merely the fact that he exists, but he also says that many of his characteristics, his divine attributes, can be fully recognized, are on full display by that which is revealed in creation. I do not have to go outside and decipher with great detail whether or not someone much more significant, much more powerful than me has done what I see. I don't look at mountains and wonder what man did that. I don't look at that, okay? I don't do that. The other day I was having a meeting with a friend of mine, and while I was talking to him, I tend to get animated, and so my hands may have been moving during the conversation. And during the conversation, my watch flew off my wrist. Okay, my watch flew off my wrist, and hit, and as it's flying through the air, before it even hit the floor, he said, "That watch is pretty cheap, huh?" I said, "Well, wait a minute. My wife bought me this watch." Okay. I said, no, I don't think the issue is that it's cheap, because it's not. I don't think the issue is that it's cheap. I think the issue is that a man made it. A man made it. And because a man made it, it has intrinsic to it the flaws of being the craftsmanship of a man. That's what we're noticing here. In spite of that, you can look at the watch and know that someone with a mind and technical capacity made the watch. Does it have flaws? Yes. And in spite of that, you can still see that it was made by a mind and skill set. Now, if you go outside and evaluate the universe, you will see displays of mind and skill set that make the watch seem archaic. Because the manner in which the solar system is balanced out, the fact that we are not so close to the sun as to be burned up, but we're not so far away as to be an ice land, is evidence of how this thing was very deliberately laid out. The fact that we spin at a rate that keeps us from being crushed into the planet by gravity, but we're also not spinning so fast as to fly off into space. That's a display of the divine design. It's a matter of display. It's mind and craftsmanship. You have a glimpse into that. And I'm telling you that unlike a watch that will fly across the room when you use animated hand gestures, I'm telling you that there is no facet of that that is broken. Everything is precisely as the designer intended for it to be. And here's what's bigger than that. He also, I love this, he didn't really make something that was functional. He also made something that is beautiful. Our God is not made, I love the ooms. Yeah. I'm just saying, I've been trying to do that for 7 years. Oh, Rashid was here. That's what this was. Okay, all right. Oh, somebody else got to come tell y'all. Okay, never mind. Not only did he make something that's according to an obvious design and engineering, but it is beautiful. God is not merely a craftsman. He's an artist. So he did not have to make mountains in the manner that he did, but he did. It could have just been flat land and we could all benefit from. The whole planet could have been Kansas and we could have all been fine. People live there and they're not dying. Okay, the whole thing could have just been this flat land, but no, he says, I want to make something that displays the grandeur of my hand and also the magnificence of my artistry. He puts himself on display. There are hummingbirds in creation whose color is a part of the light spectrum that we cannot even see. We cannot even see. This was not known until the 20th century when specific camera technology was used to photograph hummingbirds, and they had to use aspects of the light spectrum that the human eye cannot recognize so that we could see everything that is there. Well, not everything, but more of what was there than we thought was there before. You know what that tells me? That God not only created out of artistry so that we could be impressed, but God did that so that he could be impressed with his own hand. He said he did something that no one can see except him. And he sat back and said, Lord have me. This is, me have mercy. This look, you go me. That kind of thing. God is genuinely impressed. God is genuinely impressed. Not just genuinely, but legitimately impressed with himself. God is legitimately impressed with himself. In fact, it would be inappropriate for him to be as impressed with anything or anyone else. My favorite quote comes from John Piper. He says, "God, if God were to love anything or anyone else as much as he loves himself, then God would be guilty of idolatry." God is not the center of our joy because we selected him. We elected him to be the center of our joy. He is the center of our joy because he is the most qualified person to rest at the center of our joy. So much so that God must rest at the center of his own joy. He is incomparable. He has no peer. There's no one and no one like him. When God searched the universe, he discovered that there's nothing in the universe that can be compared to him. That's why he says in Isaiah 40, to whom will you liken me that I should be his equal? He knows the answer to that question. Yeah. No one. There is no one and nothing like him. And because of that, he is the only appropriate object of ultimate joy and affection. To treat anything other than him as the object, the ultimate object of joy and affection, is idolatry. It's taking something that is inferior to him and treating it as though it is equal or superior to him. That is idolatry. Centralizing things in the middle of your life, in the center of your heart, other than God, is an act of idolatry. God even is subject to the standard of idolatry. He cannot center anything in his heart other than himself because he is the most supreme, the most worthy of that affection. Do you hear me? Even God is subject to that. If God were to love you as much as he loves himself, then God would be making you an idol. God is centered in God's affections, and we are to follow suit. We are to do what he has done, and that is center God in our affections. But here's what we've done instead, according to the passage. We will take things created by God, and we will treat them as though they are God. Look what he says, starting in verse 20. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world. We perceive them due to the creation of the world. In things that have been made. So the people who claim to not know who he is are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, we'll come back to that in a moment, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for the images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Now, the problem I have here is we will read what he says in verse 23, and we will say, well, that's not me, because the image we have is someone who is literally bowing before the image of a creeping thing or a bird or an animal, or they have a live animal before them and they're literally bowing before that. But he's not just talking about that scenario. He's applying it to anything that sits in the place of God, anything that's created by God and is now placed in the seat of God. And I got to tell you something, without exception, every single person in this room has done that in some regard. It is possible for us to take something that is good and place it in the seat of God and therefore make it an idol. About 3-4 weeks ago, I was sitting down with a woman who was, she is pregnant. And she has a very young child. And she's telling us about all the things that they do around their one child. Okay, so this was how they dedicate their lives. They deliberately had their son, they started having children later in life. And they did all these things. They want to experience what it is to be married, but childless for X number of years before they brought children into their marriage. And then they started having children. And she was giving us all of the guardrails she has around her son, all these things that she has around her son. There are certain family members' homes where he cannot go. And my question is, well, has this family member ever done anything appropriate around the child? No, I'm just making sure. Or there are certain, it's not even in response to a concern. There are certain very extreme restrictions regarding experiences he's allowed to have, and she has to go out ahead and evaluate any circumstances into which he's about to enter. And I'm going to say something here, okay? First of all, her being very careful over her child is not just a good thing. I would contend it's a biblical mandate, okay? And I would also say that there's something to be said about some legitimacy regarding some concerns that she may have. So she's being very protective over him. But the longer she talked about it, the more I realized her son is an idol. Now, is it good for a mother to love her child? Yes. But the longer she talked about it, the more I realized, your son has become an idol. A good thing placed in the seat of God. Paul is referring to that tendency in verse 23. We can do it in other areas where it's easier for us to recognize. I can go into how some of our houses are idols, our cars are idols. At the church where I worked before, we used a thing that's called the ultimate home makeover. We didn't invent that, in case you were wondering. It was on television at the same time that we were doing it. That's one of the issues with the church. We tend to see, what is the world doing? Let's do that. Okay, so we did this thing called the ultimate home makeover. We went to a person's home that was in significant disrepair, and at no cost to her, we repaired her home. And we had lots of people with these skill set. We had contractors who attended the church, and we brought those skill set into the church, and we paid for the cost of the supplies, replaced all of the appliances and carpet and everything like that. We did all that stuff in her home. And the following, about 2 weeks later, in fact, this was on the news. The news came by to report on us having done that. And about 2 weeks after that happened, I saw her at church on Sunday morning, and she said to me that how thankful she is that we repaired her home. And she says, and then as soon as you guys left, my sister came with her two kids and wanted to stay in the house with me. And I said, uh-huh. She said, I'm not going to let them stay in my house. I just got it fixed. I said, ooh, you missed the point. You missed the point. It's not your house. It's not your house. So here's what you've done. You've told your sister and her two children who are in need of shelter that they cannot be in your home because you have a fear that the house would then be returned to disrepair. But I said to her, because I was younger then, less filtered. I said, well, it was in disrepair when we fixed it. And your sister and her two kids didn't live there. So you did that. The least you could do is be grateful that the house got fixed, so much so that you bring, of all people, your sister into the house so you can love on them in the same way that someone loved on you. But you can't do that. Why? Because your house has become an idol. You've placed it in God's place. So now, instead of doing with it what God would have you do, you're doing with it what you would have you do. You have to make sure that this God that's now important to you stays in this pristine condition. And I'm saying to you that we all have verse 23's tendency. We have verse 23's tendency. No one is the exception to this. That's Paul's point. Remember, his argument is everyone is in need of the salvation that I'm going to get to in chapter 4. So he's showing everyone here that there is no exception to the circumstances that's being described in chapter 1. No one is the exception to that. We all have idols. It could be money. It could be human beings. It could be just stuff. It could be prestige. It could be degrees. It could be titles. It could be something that everyone in the world has deemed good. In fact, here's the danger of it. In an American context where achievement is lauded, it is possible for us to turn achievement into a god. And it'll be missed by us because when you achieve something, you get a handshake, you get a pat on the back, you get celebrated. Articles are written about you, and you will never notice that this thing that you've made into a god is in fact an inappropriate idol because the world will celebrate you having accomplished it. Wow. That's one of the dangers of this. Going on in verse 24, he says, therefore, God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator who is blessed forever. Amen. Now, I want to say that to you because we're not going to get into verse 26, but I do want to point one thing out for you. The beginning of verse 26 is the word for. Okay? He's saying in verse 26 that what I'm about to say is the result of. This exists in light of what I just told you. And it's important to me that you hear me say that because he goes into, starting in verse 26, the discussion regarding sexual sin. But you can't read what he says in verse 26 without first bringing into that verse what he just told you in verses 18 to 25. This is an issue regarding idolatry. So what we've done is taking that which is created and we made it objects of worship. And then he says to you in verse 24 that God, seeing that happen, he then takes his hand off the matter and allows us to experience the consequences of having made an idol of that which is created. Ideally, as a result of having the experience of seeing the failures of the idol, one will return to God the real thing. Are you tracking with that? So, and I love the way God did this. God says, go ahead. I'll be here when you're done. Don't send me an email for this one. When Ellis was about three, the handrail thing. The handrail with the head thing, when he was about 3 years old maybe. I didn't run this by you first, so don't send me an email. Okay. When Ellis was about 3 years old, Ellis's practice was to go down the stairs, and he would stand under the handrail, because he was short enough, he would get under the handrail, put a hand on each side of the handrail, and then guide himself down the stairs. It was cute when he was three. The problem is he kept growing. And so the taller he got, the closer the top of his head would be to the handrail as he's going down the stairs. And my wife was concerned that he was going to hit his head on the handrail. The issue was not the handrail, it's that there are these, the attachments along the way, there's three of them, one at the top, one at the middle, one at the bottom, they are lower than the handrail itself. So here he thinks he's fine, so he's like, shh, and we will save him before he hit one of the attachments that keeps it on the wall. We will save him just before his head would bang into that. Nearly every time, it's like God was taking care of him. Every single time he's about to approach it, because he's moving. And right before you hit it, stop, son, stop. This is here, okay? He said, okay, and he would go under it, and then he would go down the stairs fast again. But again, the stairs would stop before the last attachment, so he wouldn't hit his head on the one at the bottom. And he would do that daily. And my wife said, and we kept catching it. Okay, what are we going to do? I said, this is what you do. This is what we do. Leave him alone. Leave him alone. Yes. Have we told him? Listen, this is parenting. Did we tell him? Yes. Does he understand what we're saying? Yes. Is he disregarding what we are saying? Yes. Leave him alone. Leave him alone. He's good. He knows better than we know. Okay. So one day he's under the handrail. He says, shh. And I'm pretty sure that he's fully alert. And the next thing he knows is he's out. Okay. He didn't pass out. Don't send me an email. He didn't pass out. But he did bang his head on the attachment that keeps the handrail against the wall. He did bang his head on that. And then I we hear him from our bedroom, and I said, I think the lesson has been learned. Because he fell out on the stairs. He's fell out in the whole house, and probably our neighbors know something happened to that boy. So I get up, and I go in there. I said, What happened? He said, I hit my head. I said, it's as though that has not been there since the house was built. I could have sworn someone may have mentioned this to you. Don't worry about the past, though, son. Let's not worry about the past. How you doing now? My head hurts. Why does your head hurt? Because I hit that thing. Really? Listen to me. Message. It never happened again. In fact, he walks on the other side of the stairs now. He crossed to the other side of the stairs and just puts his hand against the wall to go down, just on the way down. And the logic behind it was, if he's not going to listen to what I'm telling him or showing him, he may benefit from having experienced it firsthand. The reason God stepped back and said, I have told you repeatedly, and I have made known in all that was made who I am and the nature that I have, and you are choosing the things I created over me. So the passage says, because of that, God stepped back and gave them over to this tendency. And ideally, they will get a glimpse of the flaws of the worshiping the created thing and turn to the one who created said things. It's the most gracious act he could give them. I've shown you, I've told you. Now learn for yourself. When I let my son bang his head on that handrail, it was grace. Yes, I'm gracious with him all the time. And it was hilarious. God sits back and says, learn this lesson. Now, here's a problem, though. That's not what we did. That's not what we did. We did not merely turn to the created at the expense of the creator. But when he stepped back in an effort to make himself known, he wanted to reveal himself by way of his absence. When he stepped back to make himself known, we dug in our heels. We doubled down. And it and even more elevated that which is created. We elevated it even more. In fact, I do need to jump ahead a little bit here. Look at what he says starting in verse 26. Went too far. Not 26, verse 32. He says, though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them but give approval to those who practice them. Not only do we continue to do them, but we celebrate those who do them. Now we're going to cover what the list is, okay? But he says, I want you to understand what God did here is he said, these things are not of me. These things do not celebrate me. These things do not centralize me. You have taken these things and you have made them objects of worship. I made them so that I can make myself known. Instead of looking beyond the thing that's created so you can see the creator and then worship the creator behind the created, you decide to worship the created. And not only do you do that, but you dig in your heels. You even more elevate these things. And when you see other people doing it, you laud them for doing it. When I was about 23, 24, a relatively new believer, had been a believer for about 2 or 3 years at that point. And I asked my pastor at the time to give me I was at his house for lunch, and I asked him to give me an example of verse 32. I was that kind of kid, okay? Give me an example of verse 32. He got up from the couch where we were sitting and went over and turned the television on because he knew that at any given moment, an example of this is going to be available on television. And he turned, he started going through the channels, and I think he was looking for a specific thing, and he landed on a television show called The Jerry Springer Show. Okay? Now, yeah, and so... And stop immediately. Oh, we're good. Okay? I have my example. Okay? And he says, let's watch this for 7 seconds and see what happens. Okay? And this is a true story. There was a woman, the woman on the who was torn between two married men. And she was trying to figure out which of these two married men, I'm sorry, neither of them are married to her. Okay? And she's trying to figure out which these two married men she should choose. And then these two married men, we had not seen them yet, these two married men were fighting over her to help her determine which of the two of them they were going to choose. Like, this is pretty bad. This is bad. I see your point now. I see your point. He says, wait. Right. Yeah, because he kind of knows the format. He says, this is all set up. There's something they're not telling us. Because he noticed they had not been showing us the two men. Okay? They had not shown us the two men. And this went on for about 5-10 minutes. And then the host, Jerry Springer, decides to bring out the two men. And then when he does that, two men who are little people run out onto the stage, literally little people, come out onto the stage, and they literally get into a fist fight over this woman on the stage. Okay? Now, he said two things. He paused, and he says, okay, I want to show something to you. We actually couldn't pause at the time, but you get the point. He says, I want to point something out to you. They have security there. He says, these two men are fighting one another. Where's security? Okay? In fact, one of those security guards has a talk show that's very similar to that right now. Yes. He copied the format. Okay? I'm Steve what? What's his name? Steve, why do y'all know that? read verse 32. You should not know that. Okay? He has a talk show right now that is an exact replica of the show where he was doing security. The show was so lucrative that one of the security guards said, I got to get me some of this, okay? There are security guards there, and they did not intervene. They let these two men fight for a few seconds. And our pastor said, wait a minute, it's not over. It's not done, okay? And they went back and forth, and then they had them sit down, and then the whole audience was chanting and encouraging them in this behavior. And then when they finally broke them up and had them sit down on each side of her, on either side of her, then another 5 minutes goes by, and then they bring out the wives of the two men. And he turns to me and says, and this is supposed to be entertainment. We are not only looking at people doing horrible things, but we put them on televised talk shows and we laud them as cheerleaders from the audience as they dishonor God in this manner. At no point has anyone paused and says, but wait a minute, you are married to another woman. That was not even a subject. That was not even a subject. The subject was, which of these two married men is going to end with this unmarried woman? That was the point of discussion. Everyone got so focused on the entertainment of seeing two little people fight one another that two broken marriages got lost. But you know who grieved? God. The marriage is intended to be an illustration of his affectionate relationship with his church. And we have not only used it to disregard his plan, but we've turned it into a mockery and an object of our entertainment. And I'm saying to you that we are guilty of verse 32. Not only do we do it, but we laud those who do. Not only are we idolaters, but we encourage idolatry in others. We encourage the dishonoring of God in others. And God is not merely disappointed. God is crestfallen. Because he knows who is most worthy of our affections. Better than us, he knows who is most worthy of our affections. So for us to replace him with anything, he not only mourns because it dishonors him, but he mourns because of what we are doing to ourselves. He knows what is best, and he knows that he is best. So when we set him aside, he grieves because we chose something less than him. We've chosen the created over the creator. So some of you may have noticed over the past few weeks, when you come here on Sunday morning, that parking was difficult. That happened for two reasons. Number one, there is an ongoing soccer tournament on the field outside, and it takes place on Sundays. And then also, because of the numeric growth that occurred here, we needed more parking spaces as a church, okay? So it created complications. And every time I would come in, I was saying, I wonder if they know that we noticed that. Okay, so this is me telling you, we noticed that. We didn't notice it. So this past week, Pastor Dick and I had a meeting of all the things that we need to do in preparation for some of the trajectory that God has us on. And that's why the whole decision regarding buying additional seating came up. And that's why the stage thing came up. And we said, well, there's a few people we need to contact as well to let them know what the complications are that we're dealing with on Sunday morning are. And one of those organizations was Denver Public Schools. And we're sitting in a conference room and we're saying, so one of us needs to call DPS. Mm-hmm. And let them know what's going on with the soccer fields. And I said, I'll do it. He says, no. Let's not do that. I'll take care of that. Because Pastor Derek is the school district whisperer. Okay. So I don't know if you ever watched The Wire. But there was this. And this actually came up in our conversation. There was this conversation between Stringer Bell. Some of you, only a few of you are going to catch this. But Stringer Bell and I forget the character that's played by Wood Harris. There's two drug dealers who are having a conversation about this. And one of the drug dealers had just come home from prison. And when he came home from prison, all of the corners had been taken by another drug dealing crew. Okay? And the one who came home says to Stringer, who's more of a business-minded, more strategic person, He's Avon. Avon is the more gangster guy, and Stringer's the more business-minded, strategic person. And so Avon's upset when he came home from prison that the corners had been taken by other drug dealers. And he says to him, hey, man, why'd you let this happen while I was away? And Stringer says, we got to handle this strategically and go about this deliberately. We don't want to start a war where people get killed over these corners. And Avon said, hey, man, listen, I want my corners. I want my corners. I want my corners back. And he says, listen, we'll get some other corners. And keep in mind, these are two drug dealers trying to reason how they can best sell crack. But we can get some other corners, and that way a war doesn't happen. And I remember that conversation so vividly because when I'm having a conversation with Derek about the parking lot, I sounded like Avon. And he was stringing bell. I said, man, I want my parking spaces. We paid for that, bro. Yes, you called MSC. I want my spaces, okay? And Derek says, hey, just calm down. Let's bring it in. And that kind of thing. And then he called, and I don't know what he did. He loved on him or something like that. And they said, oh, they apologized. And said, oh, yeah, we didn't know that was going on. And so they contacted the soccer crew and let them know you can't park in the parking lot. And then he came back to me. He says, see? I called him and I said, hey, this is Derek. And they said, hey, Derek, how you doing? I'm sorry. Gave back a parking spaces. And I realized, had I called them, you know what they would have heard? Me prioritizing the parking spaces over them And they would have thought, this guy's a pastor. And this is not the kind of language that should be coming. They know I'm a pastor because they're renting the building to a church, okay? This just don't seem like the kind of attitude. I mean, I don't go to church or nothing, but what I hear about y'all would imply that you're not really this animated over parking spaces. And that made me appreciate this. I had turned the circumstances of what we are doing here into an idol. Now, Derek has idols too, for the record. Yes, one of them plays football down in Alabama, but just for the record. But he had perspective on the relationship with the school district and the parking lot that I had to get from him. Now, here's what I want you to hear me say about that. Sometimes you are unable to see that which you have idolized in your life. That's why it's inappropriate for us as the church to function independent of a godly community, because other members of the community can lovingly point out the idols that you have in your life. Is it our tendency to prioritize a created thing over the Creator? Yes, it is. We're going to do that. It's inevitable. But here's the thing I want you to hear me say. Not everyone is going to come up again next week. Not everyone's idol is precisely the same. And because of that, other believers will be able to recognize the idolatry in your life. They need you, by the way, to recognize the idolatry in theirs. It's a mutual disciple-making process, okay? But in that moment, I need for Pastor Derek to tell me, Brandon, we have managed to find people parking spaces in spite of the fact that the parking lot is gone. So even if they don't give us a parking lot, it'll be okay. And I'm Ava. I want my... So that was the struggle I had. And in that moment, I realized that whether we have the parking lot or not, God is still God. And he will take care of us. If he moves us to another place, that's a place where we are supposed to be. If he has them move, then that's the plan that's supposed to happen. I don't want for them to be so put off by the church that replaced them that we cannot then share the gospel with them. And that could happen if I prioritize parking spaces over the mission and agenda of our God. I needed someone in my life to say that to me in the moment when I'm trying to solve a problem. Who in your life has eyes on your idols, and also license to bring them to your attention? I've had to ask that question several times lately because, you know, I've noticed I always end up in the middle of a debate regarding something political or ethical. Always in the middle of it because I tend to think everybody's wrong. Everybody. You're both wrong. Yeah, you almost got that right, but you didn't. And that's close, but close is wrong. So I'm always in the middle of that. And I realized something. Everyone is arguing from the perspective of their political party and not going through the ethical filter, and then assessing the party after going through the ethical filter, okay? And you know why we do that? Because number one, it's easier. It's just easier. I'm all this camp or I'm all this camp. It's just easier. I can vote easier that way. That's the first thing. The second thing is, after you've had that party for a while, the party can become an idol. So much so that you treat God as though God should be fine with it being an idol. So God, look, I voted this way. I voted this way, and that most honors you. And God says, Brandon told y'all, almost, okay? Not quite, though. It's almost. We treat this thing, this identity, this camp with which we align ourselves as an idol. And my question for you is, who in your life is able to come to you and authoritatively say that this is an object of worship for you, and it has replaced God on God's throne? Is our humility one that lends itself to God sending someone to do that? Now keep in mind, here's what's at stake. He says in chapter 3, that we have all fallen short. We have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. When God sends that person, his agenda is to reorient your life in a manner where he becomes the object of your affections and the glorious display of who you love. So when he sends that person, he's not just sending that person for you, he's sending that person for himself. How can your life better glorify me? Anything short of a pursuit of surrendered excellence is falling short of this glory and a display of sin. You've made something more important to me. When do we last self-assess in that manner or give someone else permission to speak into that? Here's your homework. Find that trusted brother or sister. Now let them be wise. Let them be godly. Avoid people who have the ability to turn gossip into prayer requests. Okay, you know what? We need to pray for. Cause girl, let me tell you. Okay, avoid that person like the plague. Okay, I mean a genuinely mature, wise, godly, trustworthy set of eyes on your idols, so that God can be in God's place instead of us putting God's stuff in his place. Let's pray. God, we thank you for who you are. We ask that you would give us perspective on you being the center of our joy. Yeah. Not the things you've created, but the Creator himself. If necessary, God, break our hearts so that we can see you for who you are. In the name of your Son, Jesus the Christ, we pray. Amen.